to be on constant alert from now on, watching for signs of what his real motives were. But meanwhile, he warned me to watch out for any students who tried to hand me election pamphlets. School officers were to be elected on April 24th. They would be nice and offer us literature, he said. But as we paused to take it, they would ink our dress, grab our books, or worse. I've been to some of those planning meetings recently, and I can tell you, they're going to pull out all stops and do everything they can to get you out of school before it ends, to make certain you're not coming back next year. What more could they do? They're already exhausting us. Yeah, but it's going to get much worse. The thing is, lately, they've been talking about pulling off something really big that will not only hurt you, but your families. Something that will force you to quit. Judge Davies out of integration suit. An Arkansas judge is preferable to hear a Little Rock School Board petition asking postponement of integration in Little Rock schools. Arkansas Gazette, Wednesday, April 16th, 1958. This, more than any other story in the newspaper, made me fear that the segregationists were making real progress in their constant hammering to defeat integration. Getting rid of that judge, who was so important to our cause, must have been an occasion for celebration among their ranks. Slowly, they were waging an effective campaign on every level, even at the federal level, to have things their way. Back at school on Monday, just as Link had warned, people approached us as though they were including us in the election process. They would come up and offer a pamphlet with one hand, while using the other hand to shower us with all manner of smelly liquids. Sometimes they would kick or even punch us, and usually whatever they did was followed by a shower of rude name-calling. The elections at our old school, Horace Mann, weren't nearly so sophisticated. At Central, people put up signs, wore buttons, and passed out materials just as though it were a real election. They held debates and voting parties and did all manner of campaigning. I was intrigued watching the process, delighted at the complexity of it all compared to what I had been accustomed to seeing at our old school. It made me extra sad that I wasn't allowed to participate. Distributing campaign literature also gave renegade students an opportunity to hand out more flyers opposing us, like the one down, eight to go cards. We figured somebody somewhere must have a full-time press going dedicated to anti-8 campaign literature. Meanwhile, avid segregationists were fueling the battle against us by regularly appearing on television in order to enroll more people outside school to fight against us. For example, one group orchestrated a bizarre parade of cars that drove back and forth in front of the school, honking their horns. That outside pressure ignited more explosions inside as the atmosphere became like a devil's carnival, with us as the central attraction. The experience of walking down that hall to my homeroom each morning got so worrisome that I doubled my repetitions of the Lord's Prayer as I walked from the front door up the stairs. Inside the homeroom class, I was entertained by a whole new series of indignities. I arrived one day to find a doll that resembled me, with a rope around her neck, hanging from the doorframe. Another time, someone had provided genuine urine to spray in my seat and on my clothing. I decided to ask the teacher whether or not she could stop people from throwing rocks at me and pushing chairs into my back. She told me I'd have to speak to Vice Principal Huckabee because there was little she could do. The next day, I asked Mrs. Huckabee what could be done, and when she said she didn't know, my heart sank. It felt like no capable adults were in charge. Later, Link confirmed that the teachers who made a big thing of disciplining segregationist hoodlums were themselves the victims of ostracism. More frequently now, Link was full of talk about graduation events. Under any other circumstances, this would have been an exciting time of year, filled with wonderful events. He told me about the parties for the juniors and seniors. He told me about a huge gala at the Marion Hotel and said the junior and senior picnics at Central High were better than Christmas and New Year's combined. It made me feel more isolated because now I had also been left out of the events at my old high school. As our conversations grew more relaxed, Link began telling me about his parents. His father, a wealthy and very well-known businessman, had been forced to contribute money to the Citizens Council campaign in order to do a healthy amount of business in Little Rock. "He isn't for race mixing, but he also isn't for beating up anybody's children," Link explained. Judge Lemley to hear school board's petition. Arkansas Gazette, Tuesday, April 22nd, 1958. As I read the article, I felt despair creeping over me. Judge Harry Lemley of Hope, Arkansas, had been named to hear the Little Rock School Board petition asking for a postponement of integration for public schools. The first hearing was set for the following Monday at 9:30 a.m. He promised the final hearing would be held long before September. The article described him as a native of Upperville, Virginia, and a man who loved the South as though it were a religion. It was evident from that description that he wouldn't be likely to violate Southern tradition for my people. I desperately needed the break that came with Easter holiday. As usual on Easter Sunday morning, each of us twirled and pranced in our family fashion show. "Spiffy-doo," Grandma India said as we climbed into the car. The church was filled to the rafters with people we didn't see during all the rest of the year. And Vince was there, smiling and beckoning to me. I smiled back but continued down the aisle to sit with my family as usual. The Easter sermon was much longer and louder than on ordinary Sundays. "Old Rugged Cross" was sung with tears and organ chords that made goosebumps and chills climb up my spine. As we sang the last song and prepared to gather for a traditional Easter dinner, I even felt a moment of contentment. Vince and I sat together at the church dinner, reminiscing about earlier dates, and for the first time, I felt as though we were good friends again. Still, he was not someone with whom I could talk about my Central High experience. I had lived through so much turmoil since we first met that my thoughts and dreams were now totally changed from a year ago. We had simply drifted apart because we had so little in common except our past relationship. I now felt as grown up as I had once thought him to be. Nevertheless, as we sat sipping lemonade on that sunny day, there was no doubt in my mind I was enjoying one of the special moments of my life. Still, I couldn't help thinking that I had more than a month to go until the end of the school year. Central High was never out of my mind. In my diary, I wrote, "I am happy today, but I am also frightened. The appointment of Lemley means we have to pray hard. This is not supposed to happen in America. I mean, segregationists aren't supposed to be able to have their own judge. I salute the flag every morning as I look at a picture on the homeroom wall directly in front of me. I will never forget that picture as long as I live. It is a brown pasture with white sheep. As the boys behind me call names and the girls to each side sneer, I look straight ahead because those sheep are smiling at me. I think it is a smile from God. It is a promise that if I salute the flag like a good American, all these integration problems will be worked out eventually." 26. Inside Central, everyone who wasn't talking about getting us out of school seemed to be talking about the upcoming production of The Mikado. I listened intently for every little crumb of information I could get. I felt a vicarious delight just being near the excitement. From what I could learn, the production was nearly professional, with many props and the kind of fancy equipment I'd never even heard of. How I longed to be included, or at least permitted to attend. I thought I had resigned myself to being left out, but it was haunting me again. When some of the Mikado actors in full makeup appeared in the hallway, I was naturally curious. I must have relaxed my guard as I stared at them a bit longer than I should have.
"Hey, nigger!"
one of them yelled at me across the hall.
"I made up to be almost as black as you!"
That started a whole round of taunting in the hallway. I snuffed out the spark of delight growing inside me, donned my warrior veneer, and walked away. The segregationist campaign against us seemed to get even worse during that week. Sign-carrying, card-dispensing, tripping, kicking crusaders revved up their efforts to reduce our number to zero. Meanwhile, Mrs. Huckabee, the woman I considered to be somewhat near fair and rational about the whole situation, had lapsed back into her attitude of trying to convince me there was nothing going on. It seemed like whenever I reported anything to her, she would work herself up into a lather. I was seeing things. Was I being too sensitive? Did I have specific details? When she stopped behaving in a reasonable way, it took away the only point of reference I had. I desperately tried to understand how such an intelligent woman could be reasonable and understanding one moment, then seem so cold, distant, and dispassionate the next. I suppose that she must be under an enormous weight and doing her best. I tried to see the overall picture, to remember that over the long haul, she had been a tiny pinpoint of light in the otherwise very dark experience of dealing with Central High's administration. But once again, I had to accept the fact that I shouldn't be wasting my time or energy hoping anyone would listen to my reports. I was on my own. By the end of that week, I had flashed endless smiles in response to negative deeds or words. If God was giving stars in crowns in heaven, as Grandma always promised, I'd earned 2 or 3. By Saturday morning, as my family rushed about the house making breakfast and doing household chores, I lay with my face down in my pillow, hoping they would be quiet. But it was not to be. I had an early morning phone call from Link.
"I need your help," he said. "I want you to come with me now."
"You're crazy. You know we can't be seen together."
"It'll be okay, I promise. I'm going where it'll be safe."
"Where?" I asked.
"You'll see. Meet me on the other side of the bridge, just inside North Little Rock."
I was confused about meeting him. I wondered whether or not this was the trap the KKK asked Link to set for me so they could get rid of me.
"Please, Melba," he pleaded.
Hearing the urgency in his voice, I decided to do what he wanted. I felt queasy as I explained to Mama and Grandma that there was a big emergency with Thelma and I was going to visit her. It was the first time in my life I had ever looked them in the eye and told an untruth. They were reluctant to let me go, but I promised I would stay in our neighborhood where it was safe. I prayed for God's forgiveness for lying as I drove away. I spotted Link's car just on the North Little Rock side of the bridge. In broad daylight, I parked my car and got into his. He told me we were going to Nana Healy's house. I didn't say much as we drove along. It felt awkward being with him. Although we had talked lots on the telephone, he was in some ways a stranger, a white stranger. Sitting next to him made me wonder again who he was and what he wanted with me. I tried to close my mind to Grandmother's words.
"The only thing a white man ever wants with one of our women is personal favors." The neighborhood got more and more dismal. It was a part of town where our people lived in awful, run-down chicken shack houses, some in such bad condition that they looked as though they'd fall down any moment. Folks stood around in clusters talking. There were groups of men dressed in ragged, filthy clothing, drinking from liquor bottles as they chatted. I'd seen places like this before, on those rare occasions when Grandma and I passed through as we went to visit friends or our relatives in North Little Rock. Being there made me feel so fortunate that Mother had her teaching job. Without that job, I might very well be living in a place like this. "Hey, why so quiet?" Link touched my arm and I turned to face him. "I'm frightened, I guess." "I'm not gonna let anything happen to you. You're a lot safer here than inside Central, aren't you?" We pulled into the yard of one of the shabbier places. I wanted to turn and run. Instead, Link opened the door and reached for my hand as I stepped out into a puddle of water. He teased me about being graceful and having shaky, ice-cold hands as I watched him fumble with the key to the trunk. "Well, don't just stand there. Grab a bag." He was pulling bag after bag of groceries out of the trunk and stacking them on the hood of the car. "She hasn't got any kin, so I've got to keep her fed." "Why you? Where are her own people?" I grabbed two bags of food and followed as he led the way. "She hasn't got any people. She worked for my family all her life. As a young girl, she worked for my grandparents. When Daddy got married, Grandmother sent her to him as a kind of gift. She's been with me all my life." "Why isn't she with your family anymore?" "'Cause she got sick. Real sick. My folks let her go, just like that, after all the time she'd been so good to us. She's got no money for a doctor. She won't take my money. I think she's got tuberculosis, but I don't know for sure." He knocked on the weather-beaten door. "Nana, it's me. May I come in?" His voice was loud but ever so gentle as he called out to her. A feeble voice called back. Holding bags of groceries in his arms, he pushed open the door with his elbow. There, in a dark room, sat an aged woman, her profile etched against the sun shadow in the one window of the room. Long silver-gray hair in braids framed her lined face, which was worn and weary. Wrinkled skin was stretched taut over protruding cheekbones. Her fingers were stiffened into position as though she were holding an apple, but her hands were empty. As I moved closer, I could see she was wearing a freshly starched, flowered cotton dress just like my own grandmother might have worn. Her appearance was immaculate, her posture was erect, and she tilted her chin upward, demonstrating her own dignity and pride despite her circumstances. The tiny, bare shack was spotlessly clean. It was one room with a makeshift bathroom in plain view. In one corner there was a cracked sink, over which a slab of a broken mirror hung. Despite the run-down condition of the few pieces of furniture and the torn curtains on the window, there were touches of pride all around. A picture frame on her night table held a photo of a small boy with blonde curls. It must be Link as a child, I thought.
"Nana, I want you to meet my friend Melba," Link said, raising his voice to an ear-shattering level. Then he leaned over to whisper to me.
"She can't hear good. Go closer. I want you to convince her to see a doc, somebody you know and trust."
"Your friend?" said Mrs. Healy.
"Yes, ma'am. She's my friend."
"Aren't you, Melba?" He was talking loudly and grinning at me as though he wasn't certain of what I would say. I didn't say anything, turning instead to read Mrs. Healy's reaction. Her expression was angry. She could barely move about or speak, but she gathered her strength, and after a long moment she said,
"Boy, You all are going to get yourselves in a heap of trouble. You know better.
Yes, Nana. He knelt beside her and took her hand. Don't you worry about it. I'll handle it. You talk to Melba while I make a cup of tea for you.
He took off his jacket, rolled up his sleeves, and began putting the groceries away. I watched as he placed staples in the splintered wood cabinet and on the sagging but meticulously lined shelves above the sink. He behaved as though he had performed those same tasks many times before.
Mrs. Healy, you're looking very nice today.
I drew near to her.
Well, I don't feel so good, but I gets up and dresses myself. Cleanliness is next to godliness.
Suddenly, her emaciated body was racked with a cough. She reached for the handkerchief tucked in her sleeve. On and on she coughed. Link turned from his chores, staring at her with a pained expression on his face. He reached for a cup from the cupboard and filled it with water. Holding it up to her mouth, he gently helped her to drink from it.
Nana, we gotta get you to see a doc.
He nudged me with his elbow.
Your turn,
he whispered to me.
Mrs. Healy, this sounds like the kind of cough that isn't going away real soon unless you get some doctoring and the right medicine.
Oh, I'll be fine,
she said, clearing her throat.
Just takes a while for me to get my bearings after one of these spells.
Her voice was raspy, and the coughing started again. On and on she coughed, her feeble body shaking as I tried to hold on to her. Link got a cold cloth. I held it to her head, and the coughing finally stopped. I made up my mind I was going to help Link get a doctor to come and see her. After a while, he went back to his work. He opened the door to the icebox. The wheezing old appliance, without light, looked as though the inside panels were ready to fall. It was empty until he started packing shelf after shelf.
Wolf was about to get you, Nana,
he said.
You're running kind of short.
They giggled to each other as though they understood without speaking. We spent the rest of the morning there with Mrs. Healy. She coughed continuously as we went about our chores. Link again urged me to convince her to take money for a doctor. He said I could tell her it was a loan from the church. I agreed. Watching him tend to Mrs. Healy, I would never again have reason to question his motives. There was silence between us for a long time as we drove away, and then I couldn't help asking,
and why didn't your folks make some provision for her?
Whenever I ask my folks, my father turns me off by saying I'm weak, that I'm a you-know-what lover. He says colored folks are used to doing without, and I ought not spoil them.
I found a doctor in our community who did not know Mother Lois or Grandma India and asked him to go to Mrs. Healy's. When I spoke with the doctor later, he said there was not a lot he could do for Nana Healy except make her comfortable. What she really needed was long-term care in a hospital. I asked if she was dying, and he told me yes. One of the hardest things I ever had to do was tell Link. There were tears in his voice as he spoke through a rush of anger.
Damn my folks! They didn't even pay Social Security for her. She's got nothing. I share my allowance with her, and some of the folks in her church give her a few pennies, but they've got nothing like what it will take for a hospital. I've got to go now. I'll take care of it.
I decided that I had to tell Grandma India about Nana Healy. It took time, but Grandma got over her anger at my disobedience, and sure enough, she promised to visit Mrs. Healy on her weekly trips to North Little Rock. So in the end, Link and Grandma formed something of a friendship as they discussed all the tasks surrounding Nana Healy's care which compelled them to get to know each other. Court action set for today in CHS case. Arkansas Gazette, Monday, April 28, 1958. The lengthy and bitter Little Rock Central High School integration case will be reopened at 9:30 a.m. today in federal district court under an Arkansas judge. Judge Harry S. Lemley of Hope will take over from Judge Ronald N. Davies of Fargo, North Dakota. At issue is a Little Rock School Board petition asking for a postponement of integration at the school. The National Association for the Advancement of Colored People has asked that the petition be denied. Reopening that case meant my year of suffering was in vain. If the school board was not committed to integration, how could Central students be expected to accept it? Even if the NAACP was successful in getting the petition denied, it set a tone segregationists would seize as a weapon against us. Downhearted couldn't even describe how low I felt. To cheer myself up, I decided to wear my Easter dress to school, the one mother and grandmother had made for me. Lately, the ink spraying had slowed down a bit in favor of more exotic torture. Even as I entered school that morning, I could tell the prospect of the hearing had already put wind into the sails of segregationists. "Won't be long now," one boy hissed as I entered the door. "Don't phone or drop us a card, 'cause we ain't gonna miss you, nigger." I had survived the whole day and was walking through the hall to the 14th Street side of the school to go home. A boy approached me, behaving normally, so I paid him no mind. As he got closer, suddenly I felt the warm liquid spray across my chest. Ink. The front of my new dress was soaked with ink spots. Before I could get away, he danced around to my right side and showered me once more. I ran toward the exit as I held back the tears brimming my eyes. Suddenly, Link was there a bit ahead of me on the walkway. "What happened?" He stopped dead in his tracks. I tried not to let him see how upset I was. I wiped away my tears. "Shh! Don't talk to me." I kept walking, but he followed. "Melba, stop! Are you all right?" "Get out of here!" I shouted at him. Just at that moment, a group of boys approached us. Link paused, but I kept moving toward them as though nothing could stop me. I was determined to make it to the car, which waited at the curb to take me home. Suddenly, one of the boys moved closer to me and drew back his fist.
"Hey!"
Link shouted.
"You like the way I redecorated the nigger's dress? Looks better than it did before, don't you think?"
The boy turned to answer Link and then started snickering. I darted around him and into the car. As I looked back, Link stood with them, laughing and chatting. I couldn't stop my tears. In the days that followed, we were repeatedly warned that nothing mattered more than avoiding any activity that would get us expelled. Now, the hoodlums were mounting a last-ditch effort to get us out of school before May 29th. They wanted no possibility that we could register for the next school term. Meanwhile, Link seemed nervous, asking me each day what had happened. He kept harping on the fact that he was hearing that segregationists were going to do something to somebody's family. "Something big that will be certain to get one or more of you guys to voluntarily leave school," he said. But as the days passed, I was less concerned about Link's warning and more worried about the boy who now came into study hall each day, threatening to toss me out of the window, and the girls who encircled me at least once a day, saying every negative thing they could about the parts of my body. Fat thighs, ugly hair, ugly clothing, funny eyes, all shouted in a chorus. I thought sadness would force the tears in my heart to flow, but I never said a word. At the same time, I was worried about Mother Lois, who was becoming more tense with each day. At dinner, she hardly spoke. She seldom laughed and didn't offer any of her corny jokes. It was a Monday evening when Mother gathered us in the living room for a family conference. I had never seen such a grave expression on her face. "They're not going to renew my teaching contract for next year. I don't have a job," she told us. "But why?" we all asked. We knew very well that there was no reason to fire her. They couldn't possibly fire her for doing a bad job. She had 14 years of teaching experience with lots of awards to her credit. There were no complaints in her record. And then, with tears brimming in her eyes, she explained, "They say they'll give me back my job only if I withdraw Melba from Central High School immediately. They do not want her to finish the year." 27. We have no choice. We have to take the risk of talking to newspaper people. Who is going to feed us and put a roof over our heads if I don't get my job back? Mother Lois's face was tear-stained, but her expression reflected the determination I heard in her voice. We sat around the big old mahogany table in the dining room, discussing a plan to save her job.
"Those segregationists will stop at nothing to get what they want."
Grandma appeared angry and anxious as she spoke. During the last few days of April, Mother Lois had humbled herself to make several trips to North Little Rock School headquarters to plead for her job, but they had refused to reinstate her. On 5 different occasions, her superiors told her they were taking away her contract because she had allowed me to participate in the integration of Central. When the man who held our second mortgage heard Mother would lose her job, he called the note. It took all the money she could scrape together to persuade him to be patient and take huge payments. The grocer became reluctant to give us credit. Money was running out. Mama didn't feel safe taking the loan she usually borrowed from the bank at the beginning of each May to support us through the summer. We made ends meet because she worked during the school year for $2,700 and then borrowed money to carry us through to August. Each year, when her salary started in September, she'd pay back the loan. Already, Mr. Henson had called about our late house payment on the first mortgage. The bank was calling about the car. Mother didn't want to plead for any more credit at the grocery store, so the cupboards held a sparse supply of staples. The refrigerator shelves were almost bare. Grandma India was preparing more stews and casseroles with less meat and lots of rice and potatoes. She was dividing one chicken so it stretched into 3 full meals by using the back and wings in her lemon rice soup. She was baking plain white bread instead of buying it at the store.
"Sitting and wishing never made man great. The good Lord sends the fishing, but we gotta dig the bait. I say we've got to force the hand of those administrators. They're ignoring you."
There was fire in Grandma's eyes as she spoke. The loss of Mama's teaching position had upset all the members of our family. Thinking about it, talking about it, planning for it, had taken us up like an Arkansas tornado that pounded and pounded us in the wind. Now my home life was completely taken over by the same tense fretting and worrying as my school life had been. It had happened without warning. Mother explained how the administrator had called her into his office and told her he had the connections to see that she got offered a job in Oklahoma.
"You know I can't leave Little Rock," Mama told him. "Melba is in Central. I'm buying a home here. All our roots are here."
She felt an awful sinking feeling as she remained standing, holding on to the back of the wooden chair across the desk from her boss. Her instincts told her she should not be seated. You have young children and a mother to support. You need a job.
But I have a job here, she told him.
She felt panic rise in her as she wondered why on earth he'd offer her a job out of state. How was he able to do that? She concluded there must have been a conspiracy of sorts, the Southern Good Old Boy Network getting together to remove a thorn in their side. Your contract here with us will not be renewed. The job in Oklahoma is your only option, he said.
But why? I've done a good job here. There have never been any complaints from parents or from this administration.
This is just one of those things that happens, Mrs. Petillo. It has nothing to do with the caliber of your work. It's simply that we've been ordered to hire a different kind of teacher.
He paused.
Of course, there is one way you can keep your job.
Yes, sir?
If Melba were to withdraw from that school, we could talk about renewing your contract this year at quite a handsome salary increase, he said.
Mother was certain he was being pressured by his bosses, North Little Rock's all-white school administrators who were fighting integration in that city. Still, she had not expected such harsh retaliation. As she walked away from his office, she recalled what Link had said. Something bad will happen. Something involving the whole family. As we sat mulling over our fate, I realized that the segregationists had taken away the one thing we couldn't do without, Mama's job. If there was anything that could cause me to leave school, it would be to get Mama's job back. Grandma was soft-spoken, calm, but emphatic, as she said.
Well, Lois, you've tried every polite and proper way of getting that job back. I think some sort of drastic action is called for.
I don't know. Mother pondered the idea in silence. I had watched her expression become a little more drawn with each passing day.
We could call some of those reporters. The main goal would be to get a story in the local white papers, Grandma said.
Mother Lois paused and took a deep breath before she answered.
It could backfire. It will attract even more attention to Melba inside Central. The kids will see her name in the paper, and they'll single her out. And it could make my bosses at school even more angry. Those people at the school administration could keep me from ever teaching anywhere in Arkansas again. Still, we got to live. We got to eat. Ain't nobody gonna feed us. Not the NAACP, not those white folks. Nobody. I guess we've got no choice. I've thought about it and prayed about it, Mama finally said. Tomorrow morning, I'm going to write down a paragraph or two and call some of those news people.
The next day, Friday, May 2nd, I entered the 16th Street side of Central High. While I walked the gauntlet to get to my classroom, I escaped into my daydreams about the junior prom. In the middle of all the upheaval over Mama's job loss and the turmoil at school, I was feeling sorry for myself. I desperately wanted some remnants of what my life might have been had I not come to Central. Maybe next year, I consoled myself. Maybe it wouldn't be so frightening to walk to class. Perhaps I would even be able to attend Central senior prom. There was lots of excitement for the next few days, as the yearbooks were distributed. Some of our regular adversaries complained loud and long about how the inclusion of some of our pictures had tainted their precious yearbook. But as they became preoccupied with exchanging autographs, a few of them let up on chasing and taunting us. The halls were electric with energy and chatter,
while students giggled and pointed to each other's pictures and wrote in the books, creating those funny sayings and rhyming verses they would treasure 30 years later at class reunion time. I found myself standing perfectly still in a shadowy corner, lingering at the edge of a circle of joy I could not be a part of. We continued to hear snippets of the fancy plans for Central students to have fun during the final weeks of the school year, plans that we could only speculate about. Certainly, none of the eight of us received even one social invitation, nor could we have risked attending even if we had. To make matters worse, I did not receive any graduation celebration invitations from my old school. At first, I had deeply resented being left out, especially since all of us were making huge sacrifices that would benefit everyone in the future. But after thinking about it, I realized that sometimes we were excluded not as an act of hostility, but because they had forgotten about us since we weren't visible in their lives anymore. Over the next few days, I was anxious to get the newspaper to see if somebody would print the story about Mama's job loss. I had watched her go through the awkward ordeal of phoning news people. Three of them listened patiently as she read her two paragraphs explaining the situation. They called back later with questions, and one man interviewed her. On Wednesday morning, May 7th, I was awakened by the slam of the front door and Mother Lois calling out to us from the living room.
"It's here! The newspaper did it! They printed the article about my losing my job!"
"What on earth all the noise about?" Grandma said as she entered the living room, sipping her morning tea.
"That Mr. Reed, the reporter, is a fine fellow. May the good Lord bless him," Mother Lois said, as she held up the paper for us to see. She was so excited she could hardly contain herself. She handed the paper over to Grandma, who began reading aloud immediately.
"CHS crisis cost her job, says North Little Rock Negro teacher."
The headlines read, "The article stated our problem precisely as Mother had told the reporter. The North Little Rock School District has refused to renew her contract to teach 7th grade English because of her participation in the integration issue."
"Praise the Lord! We got us some power now!"
Grandma shouted. It was the first time in days I saw hope in everybody's eyes. Hope that we could fight all those high-powered white men who were taking Mama's job away.
"I think this is a turning point. Lois did what she had to do. Let's wait and see how the Lord works this out."
Grandma read the article aloud for the second time. The phone started to ring. One after another, the calls came. We raced for the telephone, delighted with the people saying they were on our side. Only a few people said negative things, like Mother deserved to lose her job for being too uppity. But some of those who wished us well were people calling from other cities. The wire services had teletyped the story around the country. People from everywhere promised they'd call the administrator's office and say it was an awful thing to take Mama's job away. It had been the best morning in many days. We actually laughed over the breakfast table. That good feeling lingered as I entered the front door of Central and climbed the stairs to my third floor homeroom.
"You better pack your rags and get on out of here, nigger. Your mama's lost her job. What you gonna do now?"
The baiting went on for most of the morning. They had all read the paper, too. I wondered if it had been one of their parents who caused Mama to lose her job.
"Thank you for your concern," was my reply.
I was struggling to practice the technique of not responding in kind to their mistreatment. I had begun to master it to the point that it was almost automatic. Still, I had been startled by an alarming increase in the verbal assaults and kicking and shoving incidents in hallways during the early days of May. The shoving was harder, and often people drew back their doubled-up fists to strike at me. Gazette and editor win two Pulitzer Prizes for Race Crisis Stand. Arkansas Gazette, Tuesday, May 6, 1958. The Arkansas Gazette and its executive editor, Harry Ashmore, won two Pulitzer Prizes today and became the first newspaper in the 41-year history of the Journalistic Awards to win the Pulitzer Gold Medal and the Editorial Writing Prize in the same year. As I read this article, I wondered when we would get big prizes for what we were doing. After all, this guy was just observing our troubles from afar and writing about them. Not once did I see him spend a day in hell with us. Grandma said my attitude was sour, and I had to say the 23rd Psalm at least 25 times to cleanse my thinking. She was right. I was not in a good mood. During those last days, school was more tedious with the kind of grinding passage of time that made me look at the clock almost every 5 minutes. Just as Link had warned, the segregationists were heating up their campaign to prevent Ernie, who was a senior, from graduating. They were already saying they were sure we wouldn't be coming back next year because we'd never last through the semester. I could tell that Mrs. Huckabee also sensed real trouble because she summoned us one by one to discuss our problems. Until that time, I had been observing fewer and fewer Arkansas National Guard troops inside school each day. It was said they were mostly not on the school grounds, but on call as the situation warranted. There had been days in late April when there were no guards visible to us in the hallways. But lately, as tension increased, we were aware of them in the building. As those days of May brought more and more physical punishment, for the first time in 4 months, I was assigned a personal bodyguard to follow me from class to class. However, I never really felt protected by the insolent-looking, boyish grown-up who wore the sneer of a brooding Elvis. The soldiers' loyalties were not to us. They made that very clear in their words and deeds. Board seeks 3-year delay in integration. Arkansas Gazette, Thursday, May 8, 1958. The Little Rock School Board has suggested its plan of gradual integration be suspended until January 1961. In a speech to the State Junior Chamber of Commerce on that Friday, Faubus declared that racial integration was not the law of the land. Only Congress could make laws. With the publication of those two bombshells, we suffered yet more increases in the number of attacks on us. Just when I thought I had endured the greatest insult or most painful physical attack, someone would come along and prove me wrong. They would go for the championship in meanness. NAACP officials had written to the Department of the Army complaining about the do-nothing troops, asking for the return of the 101st, but President Eisenhower had ignored the complaint, announcing that the Arkansas Guard would remain until the end of school on May 29th. As we faced days of grueling punishment, I was also coping with the fact that despite the newspaper article, we had heard no word from the North Little Rock school administrators about Mama's job. I was bringing sandwiches made of apple butter on bread ends to school for lunch. One of Grandmother's friends had given us a basket of apples, so there was apple strudel, apple pie, apple butter, baked apples, and apple jelly. Well-wishers continued phoning. It was rumored that there was a groundswell of protests from all over the country in the form of letters and phone calls to the North Little Rock School Administration office. Hearing about that made us feel good, but the fact was there was no real change, and we desperately needed the money from Mama's loan. Mama's bosses hadn't budged. In fact, if anything, he had become hostile toward her telling her that by going to the news people, she had ruined everything. When more than a week had passed and there was no renewal offer, Mama was panicked.
We haven't exhausted all our blessings. We haven't knocked on the Lord's door the right way,
Grandma concluded. So she and Mama decided the next step would be to go to the presiding bishops of our community's churches. One of the most powerful of our people was Bishop O.J. Sherman. He told Mother to go back to the white administrator and say one simple sentence.
Bishop Sherman asked me to tell you he would like me to have a job.
Mother did as she was told. The administrator stared down at the papers on his desk, silent, ignoring her for an uncomfortable long moment while he picked the lint off his trousers.
Oh, he did he?
He looked up into Mother's eyes, a slight smile creeping onto his face.
Mrs. Patillo, you don't like the idea of working in Oklahoma, do you?
No, sir,
she said, speaking firmly.
I read the articles about you in the newspapers, and we've gotten a lot of calls. Now you've gone and riled up the bishops from your community.
Yes, sir.
Mama's tone let him know she meant business.
Got anything else in mind?
Yes, sir. I've got to do whatever it takes to keep my job, because I've got to feed my family. I'm a woman alone. Besides, I've done nothing wrong. I've been a very good teacher all these years. I don't deserve to be treated like this.
The administrator dismissed her politely without saying another word. The next day, when Mama got to school, her boss came to her classroom and congratulated her on her fine teaching abilities.
It'll be nice having you back here next year, he said.
I assume your accolades will be forthcoming in writing,
Mama replied. The next afternoon, she arrived home carrying her contract. She sat down at the kitchen table and handed it to Grandma, who was placing the dinner plates on the table. Tears streamed down Mama's cheeks as she wrung her hands together to stop their shaking.
Let's hold hands and pray,
Grandma India said.
Praise you, Lord. I knew you wouldn't forget us.
President orders moving of troops from Central High School, Arkansas Gazette, Friday, May 9, 1958.
Governor Faubus said yesterday that the National Guard troop might be needed again next fall to prevent Negroes from entering Little Rock Central High School under a federal order.
On Friday, as I entered Central, I was wondering what would become of us next September. Link stood at the top of the stairs, pretending to ignore me. His being there was a signal that I should expect something out of the ordinary. It meant he had just learned that something awful was about to happen, something he didn't know about the night before, when we spoke by phone. He winked, and I gave him a thumbs up indicating I understood. Exploding objects that looked and sounded like firecrackers, but were really more dangerous, were all around us that day. They went off at my feet, flew past my head, got tossed into my locker, and even once into my book bag. By noon, I had become a nervous wreck. I was shaking, thinking that maybe I should go home, give up, withdraw. I began praying for peace and for strength to finish the day. That's when I remembered that I had a lot to be grateful for. Mama had her job back. I could hear Grandma India's voice saying over and over again,
"If you have to depend on yourself for strength, you will not make it. But if you depend on God's strength, you can do anything."
So on I went, humming On the Battlefield for My Lord. At the end of the day, Mama told us that she'd received the money from her loan. We started our celebration with a gigantic shopping spree at the grocery store. After restocking our shelves with basics, each of us got to pick one favorite item, and then it was off to church for a choir sing. As I marked the May days off my calendar, I felt as though I was caught up in a whirlwind. Ernie was rehearsing for graduation. At the same time, there was a constant shower of threats about stopping him from graduating. Using new tactics with more frequent attacks that involved more people, the segregationists watched and followed us constantly, looking for ways to isolate us. One frightening development was a series of accusations that Ernie had a roving eye and was flirting with a particular white girl. That mortified us because we all knew it was an explosive lie that could get him killed and maybe us along with him. The rumor was spreading around the school and being used to fuel the protests by the Mothers League and the Citizens Council. It was apparent this was a desperate plan to entrap and get rid of him only days before his graduation. However, if they had known Ernie as I did, they would have thought of another way. Cool-headed and very much in command of himself, he wasn't about to be caught in that trap. At every turn, he watched himself so that there could never be the slightest opportunity for confirming such accusations. Even when the girl in question forced herself on him, sitting too close to him in the cafeteria and fluttering her eyelashes as she dropped her book, expecting him to retrieve it, Ernie ignored her and went about his business. I admired the way he conducted himself in the face of enormous pressure, and he did it with a casual, relaxed manner and smile, although I knew he had to be nervous about all the furor over his Central High diploma. The barrage of flying food in the cafeteria got so bad that we could seldom eat our lunches there. One day, with people dumping water on my head, throwing nails at my back, and shouting abuse, I was forced to leave school. I saw that Gloria, Jeff, and Thelma also had to check out of school early that day to escape the harassment.
"You all think you're gonna have a graduation, but a funeral is what you're really gonna have. No. More like 8 funerals."
The voice was familiar. Of course, it was my persistent attacker, the ever-present Andy, who continued his threats to get me, no matter what. He had taken to chasing me from the gymnasium through the dark walkway that connected it to the main building. He suddenly began backing up his threats by waving a bone-handled switchblade knife in the air. My Arkansas National Guard protector calmly looked on as Andy chased me, getting so close with his knife blade that the book I held up to protect me got slashed through the cover.
"Hey, boy, you could get us into real trouble if you keep that up. You've had your fun. Now you gotta move on,"
the guardsman said with a twisted smile, his cold eyes looking at me as though he would much rather have let Andy have his way with me. I stood there trembling, wishing for Danny. My heart was pounding, but I consoled myself with the knowledge that pretty soon I wouldn't have to deal with Andy. Only a few days remained before school would be out. I decided to duck out of gym class, vowing I would never walk that way again. All at once, the planned events of the year were coming to life. On All Seniors Day, Central High graduates took off to go to the park. Ernie wisely chose not to participate. He was under incredible pressure as more and more graduation celebrations were taking place. Meanwhile, cards were being passed out that read, "Open Season on Coons." NAACP loses in 2 motions to halt suits. Arkansas Gazette, Friday, May 16, 1958. It felt as though parts of the foundation beneath us were crumbling. At the same time, Mrs. Daisy Bates' newspaper seemed to be toppling because advertisers were boycotting it. The NAACP was being attacked on all